From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our topic on this edition of the program, the Sultanate of Oman. Our guest, Linda Pappas Funch, author of the new book, Oman Reborn, Balancing Tradition and Modernization. In a region racked by violence and conflict, the Sultanate of Oman stands out as an oasis of relative calm and stability. Oman Reborn traces the narrative of a little-known Arab country, whose history of independence, legacy of interaction with diverse cultures in East Africa and South Asia, and enlightened modern leadership have transformed it in less than 50 years from an isolated medieval-style potentate to a stable, dynamic country. Oman defies categorization. While most citizens identify as Arab in origin, others are descended from Omanis who migrated in waves from East Africa, Baluchistan, and the Indian subcontinent throughout many centuries of trade and commercial interaction. In addition, the mostly Muslim population practices a school of Islam known as Ibadism, a distinct sect within Islam which is neither Sunni nor Shia. More recently, Oman played a central role in facilitating meetings between Iran and the United States, which eventually led to negotiations that culminated in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the U.S.-led nuclear deal with Iran. We'll talk more about why Oman stands out as a good news story in the Middle East and discuss the significant role it plays in the Gulf region, politically, culturally, and socially, with our special guest, Linda Pappas Funch. And Linda, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol. I'm happy to be here.
And congratulations on your book, Oman, Balancing Tradition and Modernization.
Thank you so much.
So, Linda, you have a long history in Oman. What prompted you to write the book, and who is it intended for?
The book, Carol, is intended for a general audience as well as an academic audience. The purpose of the book was really to spread the story of a relatively stable, optimistic country in the Middle East, which certainly flies in the face of popular notions of the area.
That is very true. In fact, recently, The Washington Post, in its travel section, featured Oman and basically contrasted it with its close neighbor, Dubai. So let's talk about how Oman's unique geography, isolated to some degree by geographical barriers, helps it develop at its own pace and direction relative to its better-known neighbors in the Arabian Peninsula.
Well, Carol, in the case of Oman, certainly they say geography is destiny, and it applies very, very much in the case of the Sultanate of Oman. Oman is historically a maritime country with 1,100 miles of coastal area on the Arabian Sea. And because of that, the Omanis have been seafarers who have interacted with peoples of different cultures and continents throughout the ages. And that has, to a large extent, informed who they are as well as their outlook on the world.
Well, let's talk more about that. Talk about its seafaring history, its relationship, particularly with Zanzibar. And, of course, the Portuguese were there.
Indeed.
Talk about
indeed,
that.
Indeed. Well, again, because of its geography, the Omanis have traveled to distant parts of the world for a very, very long time. There is recorded evidence of Omani traders in China as early as the 8th century A.D., certainly in South Asia, but most importantly, in East Africa. The Omanis have been engaged in large swathes of land in East Africa for a very, very long time, including Zanzibar and Tanzania, even into parts of Kenya. During the height of the Omani Empire in the 19th century, the Sultan of Oman actually lived in Zanzibar. And there was, of course, communication between East Africa and Oman proper, but that is where the center of Omani power was largely. And when the Americans sought closer relations with Oman in the 19th century, it was to Zanzibar that they went to speak with the Sultan.
Well, speaking of the Sultan, Sultan Qaboos bin Said, we know that he overthrew his father back in 1970. It was a bloodless coup. You might want to explain why that happened, how that happened. He is now the longest-serving Arab monarch. Discuss Sultan Qaboos's role in changing the destiny of Oman, both politically and culturally?
Well, Carol, the role of Sultan Qaboos is paramount in the transformation of Oman from a medieval potentate to a progressive modern country in less than 50 years. As you mentioned, Sultan Qaboos came to power in 1970 and was determined to transform his country in a culturally authentic manner. And in many ways, he established a new paradigm for modernization, particularly in the Middle East, one which did not lend itself to a blind imitation of all things Western, but rather a path toward modernization which embraced new ideas and technologies, but still held fast to the cultural authenticity of its people.
We're going to talk about that in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Welcome back to Press Conference USA with our special guest, Linda Pappas-Funch. She's the author of the new book, Oman Reborn, Balancing Tradition and Modernization. Well, Linda, let's continue our conversation about how Sultan Qaboos transformed this country from a backwater to a very modern place while keeping traditions. You know, we see its neighbors, Dubai, skyscrapers, very westernized, and yet Oman has been able to modernize without actually westernizing per se, that it is built on its own cultural traditions. Talk about that unique paradigm.
Carol, this has been a conscious effort on the part of Sultan Qaboos, who has had a foot in both Eastern and Western worlds. He received some of his higher education in the West, so he knew and had seen the West, but he was also intimately familiar with his country, its history, its traditions. And during the period of time before his accession to the throne, he, I believe, had quite a long opportunity to decide how the transformation would occur. Oman, you understand, is the oldest independent country in the region. It has been a country for a very, very long time. And it is that, in fact, I think, that has also influenced His Majesty's view on the future of Oman. Omanis know who they are. They know where they've been. They're very proud of their independence. And in fact, if we discuss foreign policy, we can pursue that tract as well. But he decided that he would proceed with modernization in an evolutionary rather than a revolutionary way, that he didn't want to alienate his people, but he wanted to incorporate the mores, the folkways, the traditions that were dear to his people. At the same time, he has been quite a visionary in the modernization process in terms of particularly empowering women. He has been a leading advocate for women's roles in Omani society and has demonstrated that by appointing women to positions of great power in the government, starting with cabinet ministries in the 1990s, which was really unprecedented in the Gulf.
There's another way in which Oman is very distinct from its Gulf neighbors, and that is with respect to religion. Ibadism is the main faith. How does Ibadism differ from Sunni or Shia Islam?
Well, that is a very interesting question. Ibadism, strictly speaking, is neither Sunni nor Shia. As you say, it is the third sect of Islam. In practice, it varies very little. But I think to a large extent, Ibadism as a faith tradition has also been influenced by the cultural and historical experience of the Omanis, which is to say, as the Omanis have traveled and met with people of varying traditions, they have become a very tolerant people, inclusive of other traditions and religions. And this has become today a hallmark of Ibadism because of their history. Oman currently is a center of very significant ecumenical dialogue, not only among Muslims, but people of other faith traditions as well. But I must say something else about that, which is that when you speak with Omanis, they tend not to advertise the fact that there are different sects of Islam in Oman. As I have been reminded time and time again, they will say, we are all Muslims. And they worship very often in the same mosques and do not necessarily wear their sectarian differences on their sleeves, which of course differentiates themselves from people in the larger region today.
Well, that's a very good point. And if I'm not mistaken, also I've read that Omanis accept ijtihad, this idea of independent reasoning, which is very different from, for example, the Wahhabi interpretation of the Saudis.
Absolutely. That is very true. It is an ongoing, dynamic, interpretive way of looking at one's faith tradition, and you're absolutely right on that. And that is why I believe Oman has been so successful in retaining its traditions while modernizing.
Indeed. And then, of course, back to its geography, bordering with Yemen, Saudi Arabia, and of course very close to Iran, and we will discuss that relationship in just a moment. That also has diversified the languages and sort of ethnic cuisine and ethnic mores that are exhibited in Oman. I understand that even Hindi and Swahili are spoken.
Of course, Arabic is the primary language. English is now spoken in schools. But until recently, I think it would have been safe to say that Swahili was the second most popular language spoken in Oman, again, because of its East African connection. You hear, of course, Urdu spoken and other languages of South Asia. So it is religiously diverse, ethnically very, very diverse, racially diverse, and also in terms of music. May I say something about music?
Please do.
Most folks who are familiar with the music of the Middle East think of the melodic music of the stringed instruments. When I heard Omani music for the first time, to me it was very percussive and far more reminiscent of the music of the African continent than of the Levantine world.
Very interesting. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Linda Pappas-Funch. She's the author of Oman Reborn, Balancing Tradition and Modernization. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a faithful listener, Sun Oni from Osun State, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on Facebook. Well, back to our special guest, Linda Pappas-Funch, to talk more about the beautiful and unique country of Oman. So we've talked about religion, the ethnic diversity, music as well, and language. Now let's talk about Oman's special relationship with Iran, being so close, divided only by the Straits of Hormuz. Talk about its special relationship with Iran historically.
Well, historically, the Omanis and Iranians have been very closely intertwined. Iranians have been visitors in Iran in the past. And, of course, geographically, they are divided only by the narrow Strait of Hormuz, which, by the way, they share in common. The relationship that Oman has with the Islamic Republic of Iran is unique in the Arab world, certainly unique in the Gulf and unique among its GCC neighbors. Oman has very cordial relations with Iran and does not see itself as taking sides in any regional conflicts, certainly between any of its Arab neighbors and the Republic of Iran. I think this is based not only on history, but on pragmatism. Oman is, by the fact of its population, a relatively small country. Iran is a formidable neighbor. And the Omani foreign policy is based on pragmatism. It considers that it should be a friend to all, an enemy to none. And in fact, Oman has positioned itself uniquely because of that role. Certainly, it has acted many times as facilitator and interlocutor in relations or difficulties that have arisen between Iran and the West, as well as Iran and other Arab neighbors. Oman was certainly a behind-the-scenes facilitator in the early stages of the discussions between the U.S., its allies, and Iran on the nuclear issues. Oman has been instrumental in arranging for the freedom of the release of hostages in Iran on many, many occasions. And Omani view of the world is really based on dialogue more than confrontation. They are people who would really prefer to sit down and talk things out with people of differing opinions. So it's really quite remarkable that Oman is such a strong friend of the West, particularly the United States, going back to the days of George Washington. And it can still be a solid neighbor and friend of Iran. Rather unique role.
Very good. Well, let's go back to it serving as a bridge to some extent between Iran and the West, and Iran even, and its own neighbors in the GCC, Gulf Cooperation Council. Talk about how that's perceived by its other Sunni neighbors, such as whether it's the UAE or in particular Saudi Arabia, Qatar. How do they see Oman? Do they have cordial relations? Are they sometimes suspicious of Oman's neutral or even, you know, relatively friendly stance vis-a-vis Iran, whom they see, at least Saudi sees, still a major rival in the region?
Yes, yes, indeed. The worldviews are very, very different. However, that's an excellent question. Oman is a member of the GCC, has been from its inception. And while its policies differ markedly from those of other GCC members, it is my experience and my observation that other members of the GCC have enormous respect for Oman, largely because of its leader. After all, Sultan Qaboos bin Said is the longest reigning leader in the region. He has now been leading the Omani journey for more than 45 years, and he has the respect as an elder statesman. And I think the other Arabs of the Gulf Cooperation Council, while they may not always agree with Oman's worldview, do understand it and respect it, particularly its relationship with Iran.
Let's now talk about U.S.-Oman relations. How would you characterize them, both historically and now in the current era? So from the days of George Washington all the way up now to the secret meetings that were held between Iran and the United States to facilitate these negotiations for the Iran nuclear deal. And how do you see them going forward?
Well, Oman and the United States of America have exceedingly close and cordial relations, as you pointed out, since the days of George Washington. And how is that? Because we were an early maritime power ourselves in the U.S. And there are records of a U.S. vessel called the Rambler, which docked in Oman's capital port of Muscat in the 1790s and was assisted by the Omanis. So as maritime nations, particularly in the 19th century when Oman was a major maritime nation based largely in East Africa, the U.S. and Omanis sought mutually beneficial commercial and trade agreements, which were formalized in the 1840s with the Treaty of Amity and Commerce between the United States and Oman. And in fact, Oman was the first Arab country to send an emissary, a diplomat, if you will, from an Arab country to the United States in the 1840s during the presidency of Martin Van Buren. And that was quite an exceptional, well-publicized event. Throughout the rest of the 19th century and into the early 20th century, the U.S. legacy in Oman, as in much of the Middle East, was largely based on health and educational initiatives. We had in Oman as early as 1900 what could be called medical missionaries. As your audience probably knows, the U.S. really had a very small political imprint on any of the Middle East until rather recently. And our legacy was one of medical missionaries and educators. And indeed, some of the earliest health initiatives in Oman were taken by Americans. up until the time of the accession of Sultan Qaboos to the throne. The U.S. and Oman now have a free trade agreement, which is extremely important, and we have very thriving commercial relations as well.
Well, that's very interesting. And I want to go back now to Oman's relationship with other Gulf Cooperation Council countries. Do you think that there are strains now as a result of the Iran nuclear deal? Has that had any impact on Oman's relationship with the other Gulf countries, some of whom are none too happy about this deal?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, there are Gulf neighbors who consider Iran to be an existential threat. Oman does not feel that way. But once again, I believe that its other GCC members understand that Oman is the exception. Let me give you another example of how Oman is an exception to the GCC paradigm. Oman is not a member of OPEC. Although it is an oil-producing and exporting country, it chose in the early days of OPEC not to become a member, largely because it wanted to be free to regulate its own monetary policies and pricing with regard to oil. So it is an observer, but not a member, which is really quite extraordinary among its Gulf neighbors. But I believe, again, to answer your question, that its neighbors understand that Oman is different and respect that. And again, because it is such a relative success story, a country in which the population admires its ruler, a country that has withstood the turbulence of recent years, I think that the neighbors, such as Saudi Arabia and Qatar and others, are happy to just leave Oman to its own devices.
Well, that's a very good point, and that could lead us to ask, to what extent could it continue its brokering role, so to speak, to use its good offices to perhaps mediate other conflicts like Syria and Yemen? I assume the other Gulf countries would welcome Oman's mediating role in those areas.
Yes, I'm sure they would. And in my opinion, Oman stands prepared to always serve as a role of mediator, but it will never commit troops to foreign soil. It does not seek interference in its foreign affairs, nor does it seek to interfere in the domestic affairs of others. So it stands ready and positioned always to be a mediator, a facilitator, a peacemaker, in a quiet, under-the-radar, behind-the-scenes kind of way. That is the hallmark of Omani foreign policy.
Indeed. You mentioned earlier how it has sort of avoided the turmoil that many other countries, not just in the Gulf, but Arab countries have undergone recently. We see the aftermath of the Arab Spring. How did Oman navigate the Arab Spring protests differently than its neighbors?
I think it is very important to point out that the protests in Oman were not calling for the overthrow of the established government or by any means Sultan Qaboos. But in fact, the citizens of Oman continued to endorse their leader. However, they were concerned about unemployment, they were concerned about prices and perceived corruption. And the Sultan responded very quickly with immediate and concrete actions. For example, almost one-third of his cabinet was replaced within the course of several weeks because of, again, perceived corruption on the parts of some members of the government. He also enfranchised larger portions of the population. He expanded the authority of the lower house of the Omani parliament, bicameral parliament, which is an elected parliament, so that the people's representatives would have more of a voice in the operation of their country.
But let's be clear, Oman is an absolute monarchy. It is not a democracy.
Oman is an absolute monarchy, and the Sultan is the absolute ruler, but he does not rule absolutely. And that is a big difference. He is surrounded by councils of ministers and advisors. Oman has, by comparison with other Arab states, Gulf states, has a very small royal family. And in the mechanisms of government in Oman, they do not figure largely at all. There are very few who are actually ruling members. So they are royal, but they're not ruling. Again, a very important distinction. As I say, he is surrounded by a council of ministers. And what is very important about Omani culture and other Arab cultures to some extent, is the notion of consultation and consensus. Shura, it's called in Arabic. And the bicameral parliament, which has been established evolutionarily by the Sultan, which did not exist in any way, shape, or form before he came to the throne, is exercising increasing powers. And I think it is safe to suggest that Oman is on the road to being probably a constitutional parliamentary democracy, not unlike that of Great Britain.
Well, we'll have to keep an eye on that. Let's go briefly to the sources of economic development, its main source of revenues. It has diversified from oil into tourism. Talk about the various economic center points.
The program is called the Program of Omanization, which was announced some years ago with an eye toward diversifying the economy away from total reliance on petroleum and petroleum exports to other sectors. One aspect of Omanization is privatization, increased enterprises, and also the importance of relying less on expatriate labor and more on Omani labor. But before I get off that point, let me also mention another way in which Oman differs from its neighbors, particularly its neighbors from the north. Omani citizens are employed in every sector of Oman's economy. Omani citizens, including women, may be security guards at the airports. They may be baggage handlers. They may work behind reception desks at hotels. They may be cashiers at the supermarket. Women as well as men, Omanis. You do not find that in many neighboring countries. So Omanis are used to participating in every aspect of their government's economy. And in fact, the Sultan has made it clear in any number of speeches that every form of work, every form of labor and enterprise is noble for Omanis, that Omanis shouldn't think of themselves simply as white-collar managers. And that's very important. But finally, the Omanization piece is the economic diversity away from reliance on oil. And in this area, Oman has made some very, very significant strides. Because of its geography, again, it is a vibrant center for trade and commerce. And the government has recently expended great amounts of money and resources in constructing and expanding state-of-the-art port facilities, airports, and the national railway system is now getting underway, which will connect the northern part of the country to the southern ports. So it is as a transshipment center, as an Indian Ocean country, and Omanis see themselves as Indian Ocean people. That is important to remember. Not as desert people, but as Indian Ocean people. Oman stands well poised to make that jump away from total reliance on petrochemicals. But one other thing, because of its intensely interesting history and culture, Oman will be and is becoming a magnet of tourism. Carol, you mentioned the front page story in the Washington Post just last week. It is a place with hundreds of forts and castles and museums and sites for ecotourism, for mountain climbing and diving, with astounding hotels. May I share a caveat here?
Please.
As far as the hotel industry, I first went to Oman in 1974. And when we arrived in the capital city of Muscat, there was one hotel in the entire country, and that was the hotel in which we stayed. When I returned for the second time, many, many years later, I was astonished to see how many hotels had been built, continue to be built, and I am speaking here of 4- and 5-star resort and luxury hotels up and down the coast and in the interior. So it is a natural for tourism, not only because of its improved infrastructure, but mostly because of the warmth and hospitality and friendliness of its people.
Sounds like a place I'd love to go very soon, as I'm sure many of my listeners would like as well. The book is Oman Reborn, Balancing Tradition and Modernization. The author, Linda Pappas-Funch. Well, Linda, congratulations on your book, and thank you so much for coming and sharing your terrific insights.
Thank you, Carol. It's been a pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Curtis Bynum. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.